651-641-6209. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Real Meets the Imagined, Northwest Coast Art, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Surrealists by Marie Mosé, George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor, UIUC and Senior Researcher, CNRS, Laboratory of Social Anthropology, Paris, on Thursday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by 10,000 Villages. 10,000 Villages' 13th annual showcase of Fair Trade Oriental Rugs will be held March 9th through the 12th at their store, 105 North Walnut in downtown Champaign. On Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m., an informal seminar about Oriental Rugs will be held at the store. For more information, call 352-8200.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls. For some time now, scientists have been working to develop machines with human capabilities. And as that work has moved along, we continue to be confronted with some very large questions, and not just questions like what is the nature of intelligence, although that is certainly one that has been discussed. I mean questions like what does it mean to be human? Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 has spent some time thinking about that and other related issues. Her name is Anne Forst. She is a former research scientist at the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, where she also founded and directed the God and Computers Project. She is the only robotics theologian in the country and has gotten a lot of attention for her work and has been written up in a variety of publications, including the New York Times and the Boston Globe and Science. She is currently a visiting professor of theology and computer science at St. Bonaventure University in New York and is author of a recently published book titled God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God. And it's published by E.P. Dutton and is out now on the stands. If you're interested in reading the book, you can go seek it out in the bookstore. And of course, here on the program, we're interested in your questions and comments. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief, just so we can keep the program going. But anyone who is listening is welcome to be involved in the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number 333-9455. We also do have a toll-free line, and that means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, you may use that number, the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Forst, hello.
Hi.
So, well, thank you for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Right away, when I started looking at your book, I was intrigued by your background and the combination of interests that you have, because it would seem on the face of it that the two disciplines that you work in, computer science and theology, would be rather far apart. And, of course, that's not to say that one couldn't be a computer scientist and a person of faith, not to say that at all. But it seems that the two enterprises are different enough so that to bring them together in the way that you have, this seems pretty unusual, and apparently it is.
Yep.
How exactly did you come to be the only robotics theologian in the country?
Well, it actually goes way back. I mean, back in Germany, my best fields in school.
Dr. Forst, I think we've lost the guest. Well, these things happen. You know, technology is not perfect. We will get the call placed back through again, and we will do it again, and we'll get her all set up, and promise we'll continue our conversation because it's a very interesting subject. Once again, our guest, Dr. Anne Forst, she's author of this new book published by Dutton. It's titled God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God. She has been at MIT and working in the field of computer science. And as we mentioned, she founded something there called the God and Computers Project, where they were taking the opportunity to look at this technology and then, as I said, discuss some very interesting and very large and sometimes perplexing questions about human nature and what makes humans unique. Okay, now, I think we got you back. Are you there?
Yeah, sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
Well, that's just what I said. You know, technology, it has, it throws you a curve now and again. Anyway, so you were talking about growing up in Germany, about apparently being really drawn to technological things, right?
Yes, I was always, I mean, even in kindergarten, I was building machines and stuff like that. So engineering and science always fascinated me. I always loved to build stuff, but at the same time, I always was drawn to questions to understand humans. I was endlessly and still am endlessly fascinated with human nature because I think we are the weirdest animal on the planet. You know, we are funny, we are hilarious, we are completely ridiculous. So I was also very drawn to theology, and because I think theology, at least Christian theology, because it starts off with this concept of that humans are not perfect, you know, in difference to philosophy, which always talks about us being reasonable and rational. Theology, Christian theology, is very aware how imperfect we are, and that always fascinated me. And so I started studying theology, and then I started studying philosophy and computer science, and finally I had this brilliant idea to combine all three for my dissertation, and that is what really made this all happen. And yeah, while I was writing on my dissertation, I got an invitation to MIT and went there, and they loved my work. I loved what they were doing, and so I ended up there as a postdoc. And have never, ever looked back ever since.
Well, I know that there is, I'm trying to find here the line in the book, that there is a line where you talk about how much you feel that by studying robots and by being around the field of artificial intelligence, just how much you ended up learning about yourself.
Yes. And I think that is something that a lot of theologians are not willing to admit. But, I mean, science can offer a lot of insights about who we are and why we are the way we are. And to dismiss that out of hand, I think, is very short-sighted. Because, I mean, when you try to rebuild yourself with the means of technology, you have to know a lot about yourself. You know, and what attracted me very much to the MIT project, to Kagan Kismet, was that they didn't try to just model intelligence into a disembodied machine. So they didn't try to build the world's best chess computer, because, I mean, face it, chess is only a very small part of our intelligence. What they were trying to do was build bodies that actually had emotions. And that is really what also, according to the Bible, is the key of being human, being a body and being in interaction, being social, having emotions. And so the underlying understanding of what it means to be human, meaning that we are social and emotional, that was really something that kind of correlated with my insight into what it means to be human from a biblical perspective. And so, you know, the more I learned about the science of embodiment and the brain science of interaction, the more I realized that actually the biblical wisdom told us that 3,000 years ago. And it was actually fabulous to see that what I learned in the cutting-edge cognitive science at MIT was actually enhancing my faith into what the Bible tells us about what it means to be human. And that is something I didn't set out to do. I mean, when I started my dissertation, I was kind of thinking, oh, yeah, I disprove AI with the meanings of theology, you know. And 10 years later, I ended up doing the exact opposite.
Well, you know, what I think is interesting about some of your ideas, that as it seems that particularly in recent years, as we have learned more about the world, it has become increasingly difficult for us to find some way to distinguish ourselves from other non-human animals.
Yeah.
And human beings have always been reaching for something. They want to find some way that says that human beings are at least different, if not superior. And it seems that over time we've come up, scientists, anthropologists, philosophers have tried to find little things. And as we learn more about the creatures that we share the world with, we say, no, well, wait a minute, that one doesn't work, and that one doesn't work. And the thing that you have settled on that I think is really interesting has to do with our capacity to, our inclination to tell stories and want to share that with one another. You think that is the thing that maybe is the mark of our humanity?
Actually, no. I actually do not think that we are qualitatively different or even superior to any other animal. I do think that we are as special as horses are special and cockroaches are special and rhinos are special. And it is one very, very important thing for me. Again, going back to the Bible does, in the creation stories, does not say that we are in any way different from other animals. It's clearly stated that we depend on God-given food and God-given drink, like all the other animals, that we have to die like all the other animals. The only thing that distinguishes us from the other animals is that we have been created in the image of God. Now, of course, people have thought for millennia about what that means. But I have always interpreted that, not only me, a lot of scholars have interpreted that, that it means that God starts and maintains a relationship with us. So the only thing that distinguishes us from other creatures is that we have a relationship with God. Now that is something that is not scientific. That is something of faith. So according to the Bible, there is no scientific or empirical evidence that we are different from other critters. And I think, actually thinking about that, that is very relieving. Because we don't have to try to be better, you know? And I think it makes us very modest because it places us smack into the rest of creation. We are not anymore outside. We are actually part of that. And that helps us actually then to use, in a way, animal studies and, you know, behavioral studies with animals and evolutionary biology to learn more about ourselves. You know, when we are constantly trying to harp on our specialness, we become very arrogant, and we stop listening to the rest of creation. So this is why I could then, of course, then draw the question to, okay, where would the difference be between us and our robotic children? And the answer, again, is we cannot mark an empirical difference. And, of course, I mean, what you say with the storytelling, you are right. We tell stories, and that is very much about who we are. But I actually see that, even though it's very intrinsically who we are, I see that also as a danger, because we want to be special, and we create stories of our specialness, and that has very concrete political ramifications, as we see in every genocide and with racism. So actually, the very attempt to draw a line between us and other critters, or us and robots, is the same mechanism that makes us also create stories to draw lines between us and, let's say, not Christians, or us and between us and non-Caucasians, right? Hmm. And so actually what was for me the most surprising enterprise in my book is that I were really asking at what point would we accept the robot as a person, that led me actually to study the underlying mechanisms of genocides. You know, I mean, I didn't expect that to end that way, but that was actually what happened.
There are stories of humans creating these pseudo-humans that go back a long time, and not just to Mary Shelley. I mean, they go back a long time before that. And it seems that all of them, many of them, are, at the end of the day, cautionary tales, and that the bottom line is that you shouldn't do it. That somehow that doing that crosses the line, and it puts human beings in the position of God, and that's something that we're not supposed to do. As a theologian, I guess I wonder how you think about all of that.
Well, I draw my first of all, my interpretation of the Frankenstein story of Mary Shelley is very different from the mainstream interpretation. Mm-hmm. I see it more as a story that really points out what happens when we build creatures and do not take responsibility of them. I mean, the poor creature that is created by Frankenstein, I mean, Frankenstein leaves him alone basically from the beginning. It never gets a name. It never experiences benevolence towards itself. It's never loved. And so where, when you never experience love, should actually the capability to love and to appreciate other humans come from? So I see it not so much as a cautionary tale about hubris, but I see it more as a story about, look, guys, when you rebuild yourself, be aware how you treat the creatures of your own genius. You know, be good to them. You have a responsibility for them. And that interpretation, of course, comes from the Jewish golden tradition, which is the one which has probably influenced me the most. And the Jewish golden tradition clearly says, if we try to recreate ourselves, we basically repeat God's act of creation, and that is prayer. So actually doing AI is, in a way, prayer, because we celebrate God's creativity in us. And again, I mean, this whole idea of what I pointed out with the storytelling, that we are not special. If we really try to rebuild ourselves, it makes us incredibly modest, because it's so difficult. you know, people thought, oh, yeah, Deepa Blue beat Kasparov in chess, you know, and everyone was crying, oh, great. And at that time, there wasn't even a robot out that was able to put butter on a piece of bread, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we think about chess as the pinnacle of intelligence, but there are so many other things that are so far more difficult. I mean, talk about being in a loving relationship with empathy. That's difficult. You know, being in the world, navigating in the world, that's difficult. And so if you try to rebuild yourself, you really realize how enormously complex you are. And so in a way, that makes you very modest.
Hmm.
And I like that because it kind of really ties back into the Golem tradition that doing AI is spiritual. And I know that my friends at MIT always said, don't use those words. But, I mean, they definitely agreed with the sentiment.
Hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Ann Forst. She is former research scientist at the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, where she also founded and directed the God in Computers Project. She is currently a visiting professor of theology and computer science at St. Bonaventure University in New York. She's the author of the book that explores many of these ideas, and if you're interested in reading more, you can look for the book. It's titled God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God, and it's published by Dutton. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. What was the idea behind the God in Computers Project?
What I tried to do was, on the one hand, the idea was academic. I wanted to explore the religious and philosophical underpinnings of artificial intelligence. But the other aspect was very practical. There was a big prejudice against my presence at MIT, not by the people I was working with, obviously, but a lot of other people felt that I, as a religious nut, had nothing to do there, right, and shouldn't be there. And so what I was trying to demonstrate with the God in Computers Project, I invited scientists, AI people, cognitive scientists, behavioral scientists, and so on, to talk about where they face spiritual questions within and outside their research. And what was kind of interesting, I had most of the people in the series, I did that for 3 years, were actually atheists. But it was kind of interesting how there were Orthodox Jewish atheists and Episcopalian atheists, and, you know, so it was, they were all quite different in the God they didn't like or they rejected. And what all of them were very honest about is that ultimately, even though these top-notch famous Harvard and MIT scientists have moments of awe, have moments of, really spiritual awe, where they realize they are just human, and they are facing questions where they will never know the answer to. And so it was kind of psychologically very, very healthy that those people, and that was my goal, didn't present themselves as know-it-alls, but really presented themselves as questioning human beings that share the same questions with all of us. What does it mean to be human? You know, what makes us the beings we are? Why are we ethical, or why are we not ethical? You know, all those questions. And so the audience, I mean, I had weekly, you know, up to 500 people there. The audience was captivated because I think even though the people gave also academically very interesting talks, what really captured the audience was that the people stood there as humans, as questioning humans, as humans on a quest. And that was really the reason behind the whole God in Computers Project, to make science in a way more human.
We have some callers here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Starting first with someone in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Most science fiction stories, you know, when the robots become aware, they always want to, you know, get rid of man. Seems like. Could that possibility, that theory, be the possibility that the reason most science fiction stories are written that way is for survival of the fittest? You know, wouldn't we be the biggest threat if that was to happen?
What we noticed is that if you try to build abstract, full-grown-up intelligence into a computer, it won't work. We humans are born, and then we develop intelligence through social interaction. Actually, developmental psychology has exactly established what happens. And if a baby doesn't have interaction, it never becomes self-aware, it never starts language, it never becomes smart. So what we have learned with our robots is we cannot build grown-up intelligence into them, but we have to build them in a baby-like fashion and then let them interact with us and through social interaction, through love, actually make them, hopefully at some point in the future, have grown-up intelligence. Now, if you have that, there is a bond that develops between the machine and you. It has to develop, like between parents and infant. And because that's the only way to create intelligence, I don't see any reason why those creatures who are raised in a way in interaction with us would suddenly start to become malevolent and try to destroy us all. I can see that happening. But I think, again, it's kind of the Frankenstein story. How do we treat the creatures of our geniuses? If they really turn against us, well, then I think it's our fault.
Yeah, well, that's probably because we're always scared of the unknown. And you know, all those creatures, you know, like Frankenstein was scary to them, or all these stories, you know, he was an unknown entity to the rest of the people in the village or whatever, I think.
Actually, one robotic story, which is, I think, one of the best science fiction robot stories ever written, is He, She, and It. And that's actually a story of a robot that is kind of an analogy to what we did at MIT that starts relationship with humans and is not destructive, quite the opposite. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. So if you want to read something that is not quite Asimov-like, I can highly recommend He, She, and It.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thanks. Let's go to line number two. This is a caller in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mind, I'd like to back us off a bit from intelligence and ask merely about expertise. I recall at one point that people working in the intelligence field thought that as a good exercise, you could pick a field and see if you could program an expert. If the computer was able to make analyses, I wouldn't want to call it judgments, that were as good as experts in a particular limited field. So if you could talk briefly about the current state of expert systems and whether that's still being pursued.
Actually, this is an area of artificial intelligence which obviously I have nothing to do with, because the whole area of expert system is exactly the area of disembodied artificial intelligence, which is the exact opposite of what I have been doing. I mean, I belong to a camp with an AI that calls itself embodied AI, and we are not interested in expert systems. We are interested in baby intelligence that can, through social interaction, through emotions, through facial expressions, through all that, learn to become smarter. So I know that expert systems are still pursued. They are actually quite successful in medical diagnosis and drug development and so on. But it's clear that they are very, very limited because, I mean, as you know, an expert in humans is someone who knows one field very well but also has some clue about other fields. And that's not the case in a computer science expert system.
I bring it up because at some point I had thought that people would be best served being able to access an expert system who was unemotional and non-confrontational to get help with the Internal Revenue System code and filling out a tax form.
Well, I have to admit that's a brilliant idea. But, I mean, the danger with expert systems is obviously, I mean, you said they were unemotional. You know, for instance, in medical diagnostic, yes, a lot of it is knowledge, which an expert system could have, but a lot of it is also intuition and empathy and, you know, social conditions of a disease. I mean, a disease is not just a virus or a bacteria in you. A disease is mostly social.
Yeah.
And a doctor who is empathetic and kind of takes you on that is just simply better. An expert system, using expert system to support a human being, is fabulous because they can just store so much more knowledge than we do.
That's true.
I think ultimately, I mean, at least the typical abstract thinking disembodied expert systems we have right now, they couldn't replace a human. I think our approach to AI through emotionality and social thinking is probably ultimately in the long run the better one.
Then let me ask your opinion, if you were to guess, why was medicine picked rather than the tax system for research in early expert systems?
Well,
I think the main reason for that
is that medicine is more challenging because you have all this myriad of different symptoms. And, you know, they can mean very different things. It's not straightforward. The tax system, even though it doesn't seem to us straightforward, is actually fairly straightforward and therefore a little bit too simple.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Let's go to someone here on a cell phone. This is on our toll-free line, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, David Inch and guest Dr. Ann Forrest. Mm-hmm. Dr. Forrest, perhaps following up on that expert systems question, What are your thoughts on machines doing theology, which might be to say computer-assisted theology? And also, what are your thoughts on internet-facilitated ecclesiology? Thank you.
Interesting question. Well, I mean, I've used computers, and a lot of other people use computers extensively to do theology, because especially when you do exegetical work, biblical exegetic work, they are tremendously helpful to help you figure out what's what. And, you know, we use computers extensively in databases to get all the various thoughts on. I don't think that a computer is yet able to do original theological thought. And again, the same reason for that is theology is defined as faith-seeking understanding. It starts with faith. And I try to use my reason and my rationality to understand that faith and its contents, but it's faith, and faith is something that is social and emotional, and our current machines are simply not capable of that. They are not capable of faith. So using machines to do theology, to support theological academic work, yes. Do having machines that actually have original theological thought, absolutely not. And again, the venue through emotional machines, I think, is the only way to perhaps reach in 100 years or so machines that do theology. As to internet services, again, I'm very committed to the understanding of us humans as being embodied and social. And I do not believe that internet communities can at all compare with real communities, physical communities. All research we have done at MIT and everywhere else, and the research we have read when we were building those machines at MIT, indicates that humans interact best when in shared physical space. And Jesus said, where two or three are together in my name, I will be among them. He didn't have chat rooms in mind. So I do think that, yes, internet communities, Christian or religious communities, can be good in addition to a physical community in a church, but they cannot replace that. And just when we are talking about that, let me say another beef I have with internet religious communities, and that is that, you know, in a real parish, you have to deal with people you might not like, you know, people who are not perfect, a minister who is not perfect, but that's life. You know, why should the practicing of religion be any different than being in an office? I mean, humans are not perfect, and we shouldn't expect perfection. And I sometimes think that a lot of people flee to internet churches because they don't want to deal with the reality of imperfections. And I see that as a real danger, because this is kind of like church hopping, and it lacks for me the commitment to a community in which you practice your faith.
Hmm. Well, again, other questions are certainly welcome if people want to join in the conversation. 333-9455. That's the number to use if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. And anywhere else you might be listening, use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. I'm thinking about the fact that I think within science there has been, science and philosophy perhaps, but there has been a discussion raging for a long, long time about the nature of living things, between those people on the one hand who would make the argument that human beings essentially are machines. Mm-hmm. They may be very sophisticated machines, but they are machines and they could be thought about in that way. Mm-hmm. Between sort of that pole and the other pole that says that there is something, there is some kind of essence, and you might use soul to describe that, or you might use other kind of language, or you might even say, I don't even have a word for it. But what I can say is that I feel that somehow human beings and other living things as well are not just machines, and they cannot be described completely by describing only their mechanical operation.
Yeah, actually, you know, the beauty of being totally interdisciplinary, what I have had to be, is that you learn to look at the human at the human system from a lot of different perspectives. I think on some level it is justified to see us as meat machines. Mm-hmm. The term was coined by Marvin Minsky, and I think there is, because there are a lot of mechanics, and understanding those is very important. On another level, you can see us as electrical systems, right? I mean, neurons and nerves and all that stuff, you know, using electronic. You can see us as living systems. You can see us as spiritual beings. You can see us as cultural beings. And I think all those perspectives are valid. What you're pointing out, and I think rightly so, is the problem when people who have one of those perspectives say that's the only valid perspective.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, which is called reductionism, you know, and unfortunately scientists very often fall into that, not just scientists, everyone falls into that trap, that they think, okay, they have the perspective and that's the only valid one. You know, and what I have learned by studying so many different disciplines and kind of figuring out who we are, that all those perspectives are valid. You know, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, for instance, the example I'm mentioning, when we talk about, you know, that in the first 6 months of our lives, basically we are born with a very general facial recognition apparatus that just can distinguish every single face from a non-face. And in that age, I mean, around 6 months of age, a baby can distinguish easily between various chimp faces. And then between 6 and 9 months happens the socialization. So in those 3 months, what happens is that the baby learns to become very, very extremely good in distinguishing the faces in its surroundings, but basically loses the capability to distinguish between faces it's not constantly surrounded with. So let's say if you grew up like I did in a predominantly Caucasian country and you don't see any non-Caucasian until, you know, in my case, I was perhaps 7 or 8, you have a very big difficulty to distinguish them, right, to distinguish the faces, because you haven't learned that in your all-important period between 6 and 9 months. Now, looking from that perspective is a purely mechanical view, and it is, in my opinion, very important to learn that very mechanical view. But then it's not enough to stay there, that you then have to bring in the concept of us as storytellers and as cultural beings who actually try to make sense out of our incapabilities and then create stories of racism. Oh, they all look alike, and so I can bundle them all together and therefore reject them, right? That's a whole different perspective. And yet only if we put both together do we reach an understanding of how racism occurs, how it emerges, and how we can fight it. You know, if you kind of say racism is just the stupidity of someone, right, and the someone is totally uneducated and, you know, they are just idiots, you miss the mechanistic part that happens in early child development. If you ever try to say, well, there is no real racism, it's just in the mechanism, you miss the whole part of cultural racism, right? And so I think when you do interdisciplinary work like I do, the beauty of it is you learn all those various aspects and can look at those problems such as racism from a very, very large perspective and can therefore, I think, formulate much better solutions. So I think when you talk about the discrepancy between people who talk about us as living system, as spiritual system, or as mechanism, I think we need all of them in order to really solve the current world's problems.
Yeah. Well, for those people who do believe that people are both mechanical systems and spiritual systems, and given the fact that it's perhaps more a little easier to talk about what it is you're talking about in one case and another, and that's not to minimize the complexity of us as a physical system, because we couldn't even build, let's leave the spiritual stuff aside, you know, we can't even build a good physical copy of ourselves, much less
we cannot even build a good insect copy.
exactly right. Indeed, even when we're dealing with physical systems that are less complex, we couldn't even build a cockroach if we decided that that's what we wanted to do.
No, actually, there have been attempts. Cockroaches are so complex.
But, right, indeed. So, but I guess I'm thinking about this whole issue of, even if we could do that, this other constellation of things that we are, say we call that the spiritual, can you somehow imagine that we would get to understand what that was to the point where we could even think about building that into an embodied AI? Or whether, I guess I'm still sort of wrestling with this notion that there seems it's something that you can't quite grab hold of, and that may yet be a thing where we say, the most sophisticated copy of ourselves we can build, there is still something we're not going to be able to build into it, and ultimately, at the end of the day, that still will not, that thing will not be human.
Well, you know, you raise exactly the key question of artificial intelligence, and you know, I've wrestled with that question a lot, and I actually was for a while in a project from the AAAS, from the American Academy of the Advancement of Science, where we actually asked the question, "What is life?" And it was kind of interesting because we had people who look for our extraterrestrial life, you know, life on Mars and stuff, and we had people who were microbiologists who kind of studied the difference between viruses who are not alive and bacteria who are alive, right? And it was AI people. We were in total 15 people. It was a brilliant project, and what I learned in that project was that actually it's the big question when you ask the question, what is life, is when you really go from it from a perspective from a microbiologist, right? It's simple mechanics again. It's a certain thing that happens on the way from a virus to a bacteria. I mean, I'm not an expert. I have no clue what exactly happens. But you know, they told me, and I learned a little bit, but I have completely forgotten it. But the idea is that there is something happening that is basically purely mechanic on the way to life, and then of course life gets more and more complex. The question really here is there is something special about us that we cannot build with the help of a machine, but that we cannot rebuild with the means of silicon? And for me, it comes down to a question of faith. And I answer that question in two ways. The first way is, if I were to think that there is something we cannot capture with the means of silicon, we could give up AI right away. And I don't want that. I'm way too fascinated with those machines, and I want the research to go on. So that is kind of a very pragmatic reason why I have to assume there is nothing special. The second thing is, and that is more theological, is that even though we try to rebuild those robots in our image, it's, I think, because we need an intelligence we can talk to. Because, I mean, you know, if you think about dolphins and chimps, I mean, they're all extremely smart, but we cannot communicate with them. So I think the reason why we built those creatures in our image is because we want to communicate with them. And I don't know if that means that they will ever be human. I like to think of them as human partners, as a partner species. They will be able to interact with us, but ultimately they will be their own. They will be their own species. Hmm. And, you know, will there be a life? I don't know. I think we have to raise at some point the question, when would we not shut them off anymore? Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I think we have to think about those questions, but I don't think they will be exactly like us, because when you really take the embodiment serious, then the material out of which we are built is very crucial for the way we see the world.
You get a touch on a question that I think actually maybe also is a very basic question, and we have kind of assumed an answer to that, but I suppose that some people hearing the conversation would bring us back to the question, again, looking at this pursuit of building an embodied artificial intelligence, in short, a robot. And people can think of their favorite example that comes out of popular culture. So they know what it is that we're talking about. We're talking about a mechanical simulation of a human being.
Yes.
And the idea is at some level of reality, perhaps not that you would look at that thing and not be able to tell that it was a constructed simulation of a human being, but it would be something like enough. So it raises some of these difficult questions, and also gives this possibility of the kind of communication that you're talking about.
When you say that with the robots, I mean, what I think so fascinating about robots, I mean, robots have been in our imagination forever. I mean, since movies first occurred, and I think the reason why they are so much more powerful than computers is because they share our physical space. They move in our physical space, and as we are embodied, we react to robots much, much more strongly than to disembodied machines. And, you know, again, when we talk about rationality and emotionality, I mean, for me, the best example is 3CPO and R2-D2 from Star Wars. I mean, 3CPO is this human-like machine that can talk, you know, and is very rational and very smart, and R2-D2 is this little kind of round thing that just makes beeps and bangs, right? And everyone loves R2 much more because R2 has emotions. You know, and so it's not the rationality that attracts us. It's the emotionality. We can empathize with R2. We don't give a damn when something happens to 3CPO, right? But when something happens to R2, everyone in the movie theater goes, oh! You know? So I think when you look at fictional robots, they actually tell us a lot about ourselves, what we like and what we react to.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. You write in the book about the way that people relate to and sometimes are furious with and sometimes bond with their computers. And that gives you an example how here we're just talking about a box. Mm-hmm. And if you can get people to have emotional feelings about that black box, then you can imagine just what sort of feelings people would develop if you could get something that looked more like another human. Human being.
Yes, exactly. And especially when it kind of says, ouch, or you hurt me.
Yeah. Well, that gets back to the question I was thinking about is this again, the sort of basic question I mentioned some people would ask is, why do this at all? I mean, what exactly is the point of trying to create an artificial human being? aside from perhaps the pure science dimension, that it helps us understand better how our brains work and how we work, because it sort of forces you to do that. I think some people argue that, well, there's no way we're ever going to develop artificial intelligence until we understand the nature of human intelligence, and we're a long way from actually understanding that.
Well, I think this is what is usually called the scientific goal. I mean, this is kind of really trying to understand more about how we function and work. That's one major motivation. The other motivation is simply, I mean, humans are playthings. We want to build cool machines. Yes. And, you know, if we could build something as cool as a human-like smart machine, that would be just awesome, you know? But I sense there's a third reason, and that has something to do with our fundamental loneliness as human beings, as a species. Again, theologically spoken, we have lost the connection with God, right? I mean, we were created, and we lost that connection, and we have no other species we can interact with. I mean, we can only interact with other humans. And I think, you know, our desperate attempts to speak to dolphins and chimps and our desperate attempts to find extraterrestrial intelligence all point to the same direction, that we are deeply lonely. And I think that one reason for building artificial intelligence is to overcome that loneliness, to actually create a different species with whom we actually can interact. You know, have you ever noticed that in all science fiction it happens to be that we always can interact with the aliens? You know, which is very, very unlikely. I mean, even if there would be intelligence somewhere else, it's very unlikely that there would be would have an intelligence with whom we actually could interact. Because, I mean, see, we cannot even interact with chimps or dolphins, right? Or only very marginally. And so it's very unlikely. But I think the reason that science fiction writers always think we could interact is because they want that so. You know, I think we only see life from a human perspective, and if we could, you know, see what it is to be a robot, I think it would be incredibly interesting. And so I think one motivation for building robots is really to create a partner species.
Our guest, let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in, is Dr. Ann Forrest. She's former research scientist at the Artificial Intelligence Laboratory at MIT, where also she founded and directed the God and Computers Project. She's currently visiting professor of theology and computer science at St. Bonaventure University, and that's in New York. She's the author of a book that explores a lot of these themes, and if you're interested in reading more, you should look for the book. It's titled God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God. Dutton is the publisher. We have some other callers here. We'll get right back to the phones. And someone in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah, what are you talking about? C-3PO doesn't have any emotions. He's fussing and fretting over Luke Skywalker and the other characters all the time.
Well, I think that I was talking more about that people empathize more with R2-D2 than with 3CPO. I think R2-D2 is the much more darling machine than 3CPO. And the reason for that is that R2-D2 is very cute, and that hits us on a level that 3CPO doesn't hit us.
I think it's because R2-D2 is like a dog or something, and C-3PO has that British accent. So it's like, we Americans, oh, well, it's just a British guy. Who cares?
Well, that might be too, but I don't know if I would agree with that.
Okay, anyway, I thought C-3PO was a very, very nice, kind, considerate robot and had lots of emotions.
Okay.
Right. Well, that's...
I don't like him as much, but that's okay.
One vote for C-3PO. Let's go here to line number two in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. In relation to, you were talking about relating outwards and not having someone else or something else to relate to in terms of other species, etc. And I wonder if maybe it's because you're looking in the wrong direction, and really it's a matter of inwards and seeing what it is to be human, that's where you can discover what relating is and what being human is, as opposed to looking out and looking out for another species, whether robot or alien, etc. And so the looking outward is because of refusal or lack of looking inward and really seeing inward what it is being human.
I think you're absolutely right, and I absolutely agree with you. Actually, I spend a major part of the last chapter in my book, the whole conclusion, on exactly that point, where I point out that actually, you know, that for me, in a way, this kind of the enterprise through building robots led actually to a new discovery of humans and to a big fascination with humans. And I think that we have unlearned to look at humans who are different from us. And I think, and I agree with you, that we sure first should learn that. I was not talking about the wish to build AI, that it is a correct wish or a good wish. I just was talking about that this seems to be, in my opinion, one of the motivations. But I would love if people would spend all the energy to really learn to empathize with other human beings and their differences. But I don't know. Unfortunately, we humans are not very good in that.
Okay. If I could bring up something else, and you might have talked about this because I tuned in late. I gather you're a theologian. At least
yes.
That's part of the title. Now, that usually has to do with God. And I wonder, and that's a Western perspective in dealing with God as another. I wonder if you've looked at this also from an Eastern perspective, whether Buddhist or Hindu in non-dualist Hindu point of view, and whether you've explored that and what you might have to say about that.
I didn't explore that because, to be honest, I have enough to do with keeping up with the current Jewish and Christian theological research and the current science research. I cannot do everything. However, there is quite a big school of thought that that connect neuroscience and Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge school, actually, and I've done extensive research on that, and I love their ideas. I think what ultimately for me fell short in Buddhism and Hinduism, and I've discussed that with scholars of that, is that I'm very, very, very committed to embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, Buddhism is not, ultimately, in its deepest depth, not embodied. And I cannot relate to that.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that does not mean that I dismiss it, and that does not mean that I don't think it's good. It's just for me personally, I cannot relate to it as well as I can to the Jewish and Christian tradition.
Okay.
But again, like I said, I mean, I think if you look at Varela, and I mean, there's really quite a lot of stuff going on in neuroscience and Buddhism.
Yeah, if I could just respond to that, I would say Buddhism is both embodied and not embodied, and beyond embodied and embodied and not embodied, because both of those are so-called conditioned states. And if you want to look at where Buddhism is, as you say, in the deepest sense, it's in an unconditioned, which is both conditioned and unconditioned.
Yes, you're right about that. And I have fun to think about it. But again, it's kind of, you know, you can only do science about something you can actually personally relate to.
Yes.
And I just can't personally relate to the Buddhism tradition. While I can, I mean, I am a Christian, and so both Judaism and Christianity are very close to my heart. That's really why I haven't done any research on that. But I mean, again, it's not to dismiss it. It's just that I can't do it.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Okay, thank
we
you.
We have maybe about 3-4 minutes left. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about, we have a very strong notion that there are a collection of things that are known as human rights. And that we have them merely by virtue of being living human beings.
Uh-huh.
Do you see if indeed this kind of work that we've talked about does progress to the point where we get a true or a close to a true embodied artificial intelligence? Do we get to the point where we have to start talking about machine rights?
Uh-huh.
I guess, and where do we get to some point where the line between those two starts to blur, and that we have to start talking about machines, created machines, things that we would build in our image, as much like us as we possibly can, that they have anything close to the rights that we would accord another human being?
That is, of course, the key question. When would we assign robots personhood, as
right,
I call it?
Right.
That's my terminology. And in my book, I answer that twofold. The first answer is obviously we are absolutely lousy in assigning other human beings personhood. I mean, we are so lousy in warranting the rights of other human beings. I mean, perhaps not we in the Western world, but I mean, even in the Western world, we often fall short. And if you look at the rest of the world, it's just absolutely horrible what's happening. And so we don't have, we as human beings do not have an inbuilt mechanism that automatically makes us treat all other human beings well. We only treat those beings well that are in our physical proximity to whom we relate. And in that group, we actually treat sometimes our dogs and our cats better than we would treat other human beings who are far away from us. So the whole concept of human rights is a very abstract one, and it's not one we are very good to live. And so what the key question for me, under what circumstances would we actually give robots human rights, is for me much more a question about under what conditions do we actually assign other human beings human rights.
Hmm.
So the question, you know, and I know that's perhaps a little weak answer, but I think, you know, we are not there yet, and we will not be there for at least another 100 years to actually even think about robot rights. But it's important to address the question now, because we might actually be able to come up with some criteria that would enable us to treat other human beings with their full rights, to actually make genocides impossible. If that would ever happen, then we would perhaps create a world in which our robotic children then would be an equal part.
Well, the questions you raise are very, very interesting. And for people who are interested in reading more and thinking about them, again, I suggest you look for the book God in the Machine, What Robots Teach Us About Humanity and God. It's published by Dutton, by our guest, Ann Forst. She is visiting professor of theology and computer science, St. Bonaventure University in New York. Dr. Forst, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Programs here on AM 580 made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom-designed gemstone roundtables and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Focus 580 also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Well, that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to hang around, though, because there's much more news, weather, sports, other features coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host, as usual, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll hear a story that's stranger than fiction. It's a true story that's stranger than fiction. We'll look into the transformation of Lev Nussbaum. He transformed himself from Jew to Muslim prince and became a best-selling author in Nazi Germany. Our guest at 106 Central Time, Tom Reese. He's a journalist. He's the author of The Orientalist, Solving the Mystery of a Strange and Dangerous Life. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat trading at 335, up 1.5. July, 350.5, up 3. March corn, 210.25, up 1. May, 218.25, up 2. July corn, 225.5, that up 2.25. December corn, 241, up 2.5. March beans, 630.5, up 6.5. May beans, 637, make that 636.5, latest tick, up 7. November beans, 621, up 5.5. March meal, 184 even, up 230. March